Welcome to the Sharing Culture, the show that talks about sharing, who does it, why, the history, and a whole lot in between. I'm your host and executive director of Equitable Giving Circle, AJ McCrary, and today we're talking about sharing and EGC, Equitable Giving Specific, with one of our amazing team members, one of our co-founders and housing director, Lillianne Green. We have a book recommendation for you and a sharing activity for you today as well. So make sure you listen all the way through so you don't miss anything at all. And I'm looking forward to sharing with all of you today. Miss Lillianne Green.
Hi, AJ. How are you doing today?
Hey! I always love getting to talk to you, so I'm really excited that we're having a conversation that's recorded.
I'm so excited to be here.
So I'm going to just give our audience a little intro to who you are. Lillianne Green is born and raised in Portland, Oregon. She was born and raised on William Street.
I was born at Emmanuel Hospital, so.
Hey, there you, okay, so right there. She has a consulting business, North Star Forward. She is one of the co-founders and the housing director for Equitable Giving Circle. She's also a board member for Oregon Black Pioneers, as well as has a nonprofit that she runs, Operation Back to School. So Lillianne is out here doing everything. She's also a parent and has kiddos that she takes care of. And it's just all around an amazing human being. I love talking with you. Lillianne is so smart. And it's really fun to organize with you. Did I miss anything?
I don't think you did. I think you gave the wide gambit of experiences right there.
She's also very talented with crafts. And this is, I don't have permissions. I'm just going to like ask for forgiveness. Oh, but she quilts. How cool is that? I feel like that's one of those lost arts. And it's really cool to hear about millennials that are doing, like holding on those traditions, those practices. And yeah, she does everything. You do. I'm not lying. Very talented. And it's exciting to work with her. We kind of got to know each other through this project. Mm-hmm. And like I said, you're one of my favorite people to chat with. And so this is going to be a good conversation. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions that I've been asking everybody. What was your most favorite thing that anyone has shared with you?
Ooh. I'm going to go with my name. I am actually named after my mother. My father named me. I remember I was just like, why did my name come up? He was like, well, you were our last girl and I just saw you. And I was just like, I'm going to name you after your mom. So that's a beautiful thing that we share together, and having that and having, she's no longer with us on this earth, but having that name and being able to carry it on and just hearing it invoked in different spaces always reminds me of her and reminds me of my father. So just having that and sharing the legacy of that name that came from one of my aunts in the South, that is just a piece of our family lineage that I'm proud to carry on.
Lillianne is a beautiful name. And I know that your mom would be so proud of you and all of the things that you do because you're a badass and you're like out here literally changing the world.
Well, I got it from her, so hey! I'm just carrying that on.
Shout out Mama Lillianne. All right. I'm sure she's watching and just like overwhelmed with pride. You really do a lot in community. And you're just a dope person. What was one of the most meaningful things outside of your name that you've shared with somebody else?
That I shared with somebody else. I think for me, when I think about this concept of sharing, I want to throw myself all in. I don't believe that when we're talking about sharing in community or like supports for community, that we should, you know, just sit back and hope that someone asks us for help. When you're in community, when you're up community, when you see something's going awry, or if you see someone that needs support, then like I want to be that individual within community, within my family, that's, you know, providing that support, sharing. I'm demonstrative. So like I may not say a lot, but I am a person that's going to show you. So I am the one that will probably make you a meal, clean your house. I am the person that's going to like babysit your kids. I'm the person that's going to follow up with you. So I think for me, like sharing my love in the ways in which I demonstrate that in community is one of the biggest gifts, and just showing up and being there for others. Because sometimes we hear the well wishes or like, I'll pray for you, I hope you're good. And while all those are great, sometimes you just physically need someone to be there. And when I'm able to, like, that's a thing for me, is like showing up. And as some of y'all may know, I grew up in this area. My mom and dad was, you know, pillars in the community, Charles and Lillian Green. So having that as the example, and they showed up, they were deep in community. They were in our schools. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, working within, working with other youth. They had 10 children. And even though they had 10 children, my parents both worked in the school districts and they were there. So like it comes natural because I had it demonstrated to me from like the moment I was born.
Yeah. I love that you both have the example of it, and it's something that you actively do. And I can say, as someone who gets to witness, you are about this sharing life in more ways than one. And it's cool because one of my favorite things to do is share. So I like hanging out with people that like to share. And what do you share the most?
Ooh, what do I share the most?
Besides wisdom, because you be dropping nuggets all the time.
I would say one of the projects that I am just most like proud of, that like just makes me smile all the time. As you said earlier, I started Operation Back to School, One Cause Many Hands. It is a every year we provide backpacks, you know, close to most years over 1,000+ backpacks full of supplies to children across Multnomah and Washington County. It was started by one of my sisters. She passed away, and she was a school teacher. And we wanted to do something to commemorate her life because she almost 20 years of school teaching, and she loved her students. So we started 1 year and did 100 backpacks to donate to the school that she taught, she last taught at. And then people were just like, hey, do you have more backpacks? And we're like, no, we don't have any more backpacks this year. And they were like, well, if you do it again, let us know. And since 2018, we have been providing over like 7,000 backpacks to children in Washington and Multnomah County through a variety of schools, culturally specific nonprofits, DHS offices. And I think for me, it's just like, it's an act of service that's in commemoration of my sister. And every time I get to see her daughters that help out, or just like as we're packing bags as families, is a gift not only for community, but also to my family, to sit and like reflect on like her and all the amazing things that she's done here. So I, for me, like yearly, like that's something I look forward to. It's about to happen soon. So there will be more out. But like that's something that like for me is a give back to the community that means a great deal to me.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, Operation Back to School is amazing. Can we plug the website real fast? Because I'd like to share that with y'all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's operationbacktoschool.com. It's an amazing website. You can check it out, donate, and check us out because, you know, we're just going to continue on doing the great work.
Yeah. So if you got new school supplies or backpacks, or you got some money that you want to share with this amazing project or organization, this legacy work, please holler at Lillian about backpack support. I've been able to, in little ways, help with that. And it's cool. And it's just special. And I don't think people realize how much school supplies, if you don't have kids or it's been a long time, like I haven't had to deal with the new school stuff in a while because my kid is, we're done with that. It's a lot. It's a stressful time. So it's such a big gift that, you know, each individual family or kid, you know, gets to have. And, you know, those supplies matter in terms of kids being set up for success and having, you know, like people forget about their physical supports that our young scholars need.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Awesome. Okay. So those were our little rapid fire questions. And now I'm going to ask you what radicalized you? And I ask you that because Equitable Giving Circle is all about radical sharing. Mm-hmm. We give no strings attached. We are very radical as a group in comparison to a lot of other people. No shade to anybody else, because that's not what we're about. But we just are very, we as a team talk about this all the time. Everyone should have free food. Everyone should have free housing. Mm-hmm. Like, all these basic things shouldn't be what's holding people back or holding people down. So what radicalized you?
Ooh, I remember we were having a conversation maybe a week or so ago, and I was just like, if my neighbor's not good, then I'm not good.
Yeah.
And I think that was a lesson that was like just ingrained in me for a very long time. So it's very weird to talk about this concept of radicalization on something that I think are just basic human needs. Like, no one should want for housing. No one should want for healthcare. No one should want for food. Mm-hmm. Like, all of our basic needs should be met. And we have the financial resources to do that. So it's a myth to say that, you know, we're unable to do that. We're unable to house anyone. We're unable to feed everyone, because we know that's fiscally not true. And we know that if we did do it, it would cost our society a heck of a lot less.
Wait,
than,
say that last part.
Let me repeat that. Let me throw it out there for the people in the back. If we actually put in these programs, it would cost our society a lot less fiscally than what we're doing right now. So when we're talking about systems of oppression, when we're talking about, like, poverty is man-made, we create stratas within society that's man-made. So it's not that we have to live like this. So I don't ascribe to trying to replicate a society that has not served me or my community. And I'm trying to do the exact opposite of it. So when people say, oh, this is radical, it's like, is this radical or should this be the norm? But we know that we live in a society that's impacted by systems of oppression. So when we're actively fighting those systems of oppression, that creates this stratification, that creates these artificial, you know, needs within our society that does not have to be there. Yes, it is radical to push against a normalized system of oppression.
Boom. See what I said when I said that this young woman drops nuggets of just wisdom and... Wow. Yes.
So, and I think, well, so as I was, you know, things just didn't click for me. So I remember being young and saying, like, I was the kid. I just remember we were learning about the Oregon Trail. I was like, if you're from Oregon, you done read about the Oregon Trail in those history books.
Did you play the game?
I did play the game. I died of dysentery so many times. It's not even funny. But I just remember being in school and we're reading about Manifest Destiny. And it wasn't them talking about Manifest Destiny, like, in a neutral way. It was, like, almost praising, like, it had to have happened in order for us to expand westward. And I was, like, I remember my, like, second or third grade self, and I was, like, they, like, the Native American people were here already. How did they, like, they took their stuff. And, like, even though I was, like, very young and didn't have all the pieces there, and I was, like, it was still, like, nah, this don't sit well with me. And I was always that kid that questioned. So if you ever talk to me for long periods of time, I'm going to sit and ask you 1,001 questions. And I'm okay with that. But I am the one that's going to start questioning things. And I was always somebody that when it didn't make sense to me, I was going to question it. And some people liked that about me. Some people hated it about me. But that was something that I was like, I was always going to press a question in inequities that showed up in our society. And it just happened from, like, a very young age where my mom would be like, oh, baby, go on, play somewhere else. Like, let's do something else real quick. Because I was going to ask those questions. And from asking those questions, I then had to make a decision. I was just like, how do I show up then in community? How do I show up for myself? How do I show up for others? And it just led me on this quest of, like, actively pushing back against things that I was just like, I wouldn't want this for me. I don't want this for others. How do we make a difference around that?
Yeah. So much there, just goodness and just like so many things I want to take away. Oh my gosh, not take away, like, but that I want to hold on to. That's just, yeah. I love the way that you remind us that this isn't radical. I mean, it's radical in the society that we live in, but when you actually unpack it, that this isn't radical. And I really appreciate your questions, because you can't do this type of work. You can't do community work. You can't do, you know, dismantle systems. You can't build new systems if you're not asking questions.
Yeah.
Like, it just doesn't make sense. Are there any questions that you like to ask yourself or projects regularly that you think are good questions to kind of help get the get things moving?
Yeah, I think that I also like I have to be in spaces where people are going to challenge me through questions as well. So I do think that collaborative team building, collaborative problem solving is really key to it. When you sit in isolation, it's really easy to like, I always like to describe like when we're thinking about systems of oppression, it's ever evolving. It's something, it's a living amoeba entity that, you know, you could just say like you could move forward a really great idea where you seek out community feedback and then you implement a program. However, if you don't go back within a year or two and check back in with community, say, hey, is this still working? What do we need to change? If you never do that, then that program that was supposed to interrupt systems of oppression can then be producing it because it's no longer meeting community needs or actually being reflective. So for me, I always want to say like, okay, who's in the room? Who's not in the room? Mm. What am I basing? What assumptions am I making here? Like, for the whatever projects that I'm doing, whatever, you know, thing I'm trying to make a decision on, I'm just like, okay, what assumptions am I making? Or if I could say like, hey, Lillian, if you stepped out of this experience and like devoid of like whether or not someone's related to you or your friends, like if you just looked at this for the facts in front of you, what would you say? I think that's really key because sometimes I was just like, even with the best of our abilities. And I sit mm-hmm. in circles where, you know, we're constantly, if you ever in a conversation with me, you already know what we about to be talking about. I do not do small talk well, so hey. But if you're in a conversation with me, like, it's, you always have to pause and be like, okay, is there groupthink happening here? Mm-hmm. And even with people who are steeped in diversity, equity, and inclusion work, I always say this, like, I do this for a living as a personal, academic, professional passion of mine. So I'm constantly in these spaces, but also I have to pause and I'm just like, is there group things happening? If I do something or make one decision, is this just easier for me? Do I have to do less work here? Am I, you know, less impacted by certain systems of oppression? Or do I feel like I'm going to get less blowback? Which I do think it's like a really big thing that, you know, a lot of people in our realm and the type of work that we do all the time, you have to consider because I've been in places and spaces. I've received death threats. I have, you know, have people try to dox me. Like, you know, you've been in these spaces and like there's moments where you're just like, I don't want to deal with that. Mm-hmm. So do I carve out a message differently? Do I say differently? Do I not say anything at all? Mm-hmm. And I think those are some of the key things that I have to think about and just being unapologetic about, like, you know, I am only on this earth for a finite amount of time. And if the Lord's put something in me to get out there, like I'm going to need to get it out there because I can't sit with it because it doesn't do me any good. It doesn't mm-hmm. do my... are like, you know, the future generations any good for me to be quiet on something that my ancestors had to fight tooth and nail for me just to be here, just for us to be in the space to have this conversation, to be in this podcast. I think back to the generations and generations and generations. Mm-hmm. Like I, you know, I do genealogy in my family and I was just like, my great, 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 great grandmother that like was documented through the Freeman Bureau with, you know, had to live in order for me to be in this space. And I dare not do anything to tarnish like all the sacrifices she had to make mm-hmm. in order for me to be here. So I just constantly try to, you know, how am I projecting voices and how do I question myself to make sure that I'm not perpetuating systems of oppression through the lack of exploration or creativity around the questions that I'm asking myself.
Yeah, that's like such a beautiful call to action for all of us. I know we do that. I do that in my work, both with EGC and elsewhere. We do that as a team. I think that's such a beautiful call to action for everybody to kind of get into and start asking those questions. And it's hard.
It is.
It's definitely hard. But I would say, at least for me, the more I do it, and I've been doing this since I was a little person too, because, yeah, I'm very, very bright and black person. It's a lot of questions. And witnessed lots of different things, just, you know, being around, you know, my black family members who I was raised around and with, you know, I became that person asking questions. Why did they say that? Why are they, mm-hmm. why is it different? I came in here with mom the other day and it was not like this at all.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is, you know.
They don't read right.
Yeah. You know, so I think that's just a beautiful call to action to ask people, you know, start asking those questions. And the more that you do it, because we've been doing these things for, since we were very little people for, you know, 30 years. I know I've been asking questions my whole memory. I was encouraged to. The more you do it, the easier it is.
I think it the easier it is, and you get better at it, and mm-hmm. you get to a point where I was just like, you have to humble yourself. And I mean, like, especially if you feel as if you have steeped yourself in the diversity, equity, inclusion space. And I see this all the time for allies and people of the like that's doing this work. They'll be like, well, I've been doing this for 10, 20 years. And I was just like, and we still have to humble ourselves to say, like, and systems of oppression, the acting, been working for thousands of years mm-hmm. And been reproducing themselves to mold to the society in which it exists in. So we can't get into, we can't become lax in questioning ourselves or getting upset. Cause I do, you get to a point where you're just like, I've been doing this work for so long. Like, why do I even have to do that? That's like a waste of my time. But I was like, is it?
Yeah, I will say anytime I do a facilitation training, like me being trained up or participating in the workshop, even though I'm like, I could be teaching this, I learned something.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people don't really engage with that this is ongoing work. That even as like somebody who is an expert or leading a type of this work or a project, we need that ongoing work because we live in a society that is steeped in white supremacy. And, you know, I had a conflict or I'm in a conflict that I told somebody, I said, well, being dismissive in this way is a product of white supremacy. Like, mm-hmm. this is what white supremacy looks like in motion. And it, oh, it ruffled the feathers. Everyone's feathers are still ruffled. It's still an active thing. I'm like, and not addressing this conflict, right? Like, just being like, no, I don't like that you said that or that you're bringing that up. We're done. Mm-hmm. Well, that's white supremacy. And like, that's white supremacy culture. I did not call anybody a white supremacist. That's very, that is a serious thing to say. If the shoe fits, the shoe fits. And right. one of the people within this conflict was like, he was very upset. And he's like, I can't believe you called me a white supremacist. And I was like, I said, no, I said, what is happening here is of this culture. Right. And we're all steeped in it. And it was really interesting to even see how, you know, you bring that up mm-hmm. and it's like, I didn't call you that. And there's, you know, we all are in this. This is our culture. Capitalism is a type of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. You know, like, be mad. I'm sure I'm going to get an email about that.
Well, I think if when you
talk, I would love to have a conversation.
When you think about white identity development from the abolitionist to white supremacy and how it shows up on a spectrum. And again, like, even as a Black queer person that has grew up in the Portland metro area, I grew up in a system of white supremacy. I grew mm-hmm. up. That's where I grew up in. That's like the ocean in which I existed in. So I also have to ask myself, how is whiteness showing up for me in this moment? How is this impacting my decision? What I do, what I don't do? So I do think this is like, it's like a weird moment where people are just like, oh, like it's like, no, we all have to question how whiteness shows up. And the moment we see how whiteness shows up, we have to think about how are we going to counteract that? Like as loud and as bold as it showed up and what we were doing or what we were about to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of those moments where, you know, people have like that tension moment. And I was like, and me sitting in the space and place that I am in, I have to ask, how did whiteness impact what I said, how I mm-hmm. said it, how I showed up in the space, what I said, what I didn't say. And that is a constant thing that I have to do on a daily. So we all have to question that. And if you feel some type of way when someone calls that out, ask the moment, like, did you address what they said? Or are you just solely focusing on the fact that someone dared said that whiteness showed up for you and is asking you to reflect on that?
Yeah, it's hard. And that action, though, right? Like when you start getting into it and dissecting it and unpacking it and asking those questions, that's where the magic is, right? That's mm-hmm. where healing happens. That's where growth happens. You know, accountability is hard, but
yep.
getting into these questions, you know, it doesn't necessarily always, sometimes it needs to be public. Sometimes it needs to include other people. And sometimes these are things that you could, you know, self-reflect on, journal mm-hmm. about. And you've got to be the right person to decide that and, you know, how things are moving. But asking those questions and being in the action part, mm-hmm. right? It's like, it's not enough to just read about it. It's not enough just to reflect, but then it's like, you reflect and it's like, okay, how do I grow? Where do I tap in? It's an action.
And to be honest, I'm about to, say something that will ruffle a lot of people's feathers. And I was like,
hey, another feather ruffler.
So all of us that went to the bookstore that brought many amazing books that are now sitting on your bookshelf that you have not cracked, or you're still on chapter one, you are still in a book club about, that is not action. That is, intellectualizing an issue. And then after that, after you read about it, after you have to reflect on it, you have to do something different. And reading is not going to be the be all end all. And I tell this to people all the time. So if people feel in some type of way, feel some type of way. But if you are listening to this and if you brought some books and you've been telling people that you brought books and you haven't read any of those books and you haven't applied a single lesson from those books other than the back page that you read, then you can see how that inaction, mm-hmm. that is a component of whiteness, because in order to maintain a system of oppression, we actually have to do nothing, which is a wild thing that people, I tell people all the time, I was just like, we just have to exist the way in which we're existing to allow a system of oppression to grow. So in order for us to, I'm harping back to your question around radicalization, like we need to be radical in how are we interrupting how white supremacy shows up, how all these systems of oppression shows up and intersects in the different spaces that we're in. Because if we don't do that, then we are doing exactly what the system of oppression wants us to do, which is nothing.
Facts. On that reading, just a hot tip for anybody, read one chapter a day and make that a habit. I once had a professor who was like, AJ, you to really be an intellect or whatever. And he had like 76 degrees or something ridiculous. One of those kinds of professors. And he's like, you got to read 200 pages a day. And no. So my crazy behind, I should not say that. My ridiculous self, because I am ridiculous in all of the good ways and sometimes others, really tried this for a summer. So for a summer, I worked really hard on reading 200 pages. I did halfway through this make some small adjustments. So sometimes I would read children's books to my, at the time, a baby, so I could make I could do the quota. But I worked really, really hard on it. And it did help me become an even stronger reader. So if you need a fun activity, it's a hard activity. Try that. But my takeaway from that was not so much about intentionally having to read pretty much a book a day, but that serious commitment. And so reading a chapter a day is a more realistic takeaway for me as a human. But an opportunity for, you know, I think everyone to engage with, if you want this knowledge and you want it to be consistent, that's bite size. And it gives you enough time. Mm-hmm. Like if you read, you know, like figure out if like I like to read in the morning time. Before, I like to do everything in the morning, and then by 4 o'clock, I'm done with my day is my goal. But if I read in the morning, it gives me time throughout the day, my quiet moments, maybe I'm standing in a line or whatever, to think about what I read and how I can apply that. Or if I have more questions or, you know, like I can kind of, you know, really dissect it or absorb it.
And I think that's so true. Cause again, like I'm a reader, I love reading, and I also love intellectualizing an issue. So I can, again, like you can read that entire book, and for us to actively interrupt system there, I would rather you read a couple chapters out of an amazing book and then work the next year or applying that in every aspect of your life than trying to rush through a book, never act upon it, or just like, again, like use it as a talking point, which I think is just such a fad now to be like, I'm just going to use this as a talking point. This is going to be something that I bring up in selective conversations. And again, I'm going to ruffle some feathers. Like if you only bring up the anti-racist, anti-system of oppression books and readings to like-minded crowds because you don't want to talk to your family about it, you don't want to talk about it at your workplace, you only talk about it and you're like when you're chilling with your friends or you're chilling with your friends that are receptive to it, red flag, red flag, red flag. the system of oppression is playing out really hardcore in you. Because you also know in this moment that there's certain spaces that you can talk about this and not be chastised, and spaces that if you do talk about this, you will be chastised. So that's why you don't bring it up as easily.
Ooh, facts. Yeah. So I will say, the more that you get into this work, the more you talk about it, the more you practice having those hard conversations. And it's practice, right? Like most things, it's practice. Yeah. The easier it gets, doesn't mean the conversations get easier.
No.
But being able to be that disruptor to say, hey, can I call y'all in and can we maybe talk about this? Because that's not sitting well. Or this equals this, or this is connected to this. And is that the intention here? Because I could be in the wrong place. Or are you realizing this? And I like to remind people and myself, if I'm asking to, like, can we get into it a little bit? Can we unpack this? Can we dissect this? It's because I care.
Yeah.
Because I value you, the project. There's something here worth
the engagement.
Yeah. If it's dismissive, it's like, well, bunk this and I don't want to participate and I don't care. That means there's nothing salvageable. There's no value. And so anytime anybody is saying, hey, I want to discuss this conflict, because there's some care there and there's hope. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you don't have to be accountable. But there's opportunity.
And I feel like some of the most fruitful conversations that I've had have been the conversations that I entered in and I was feeling the most, like, uncomfortable. Because I would like to make a distinction. There's a difference between feeling unsafe and uncomfortable. Like, I was like, if you're ever in a situation, I'm not like, if you're feeling unsafe, like, you need to get to safety. Like, period, point blank. However, if I'm going to a conversation and I'm feeling uncomfortable because I'm learning something new, I'm being stretched in a way in which I've never been stretched before, we have to, I ask people to lean into the uncomfortable conversations. If it's unsafe, that's a whole different story. But if it's just uncomfortable, because there's been the strongest learning moments I've had is when people have felt comfortable enough and been like, hey, Lillian, you just said this, and I don't think that was your intention. However, this is how it landed, or this is an assumption that you made here. And I was just like, I did make that assumption. And I had to sit with it, and I had to, you know, absorb it, and I had to think about, like, you know, how do I repair the harm that was done in that space, whether it was intentional or unintentional, and then how do I grow from it? Because then I can't, now that I know, I know. And you can't pretend that you don't know once you know it.
Yeah. Accountability. It's a big part of this work. And it's not fun. A lot of things aren't fun, though. Yeah. All right. We're going to build on this, because a lot of this is why EGC exists.
It is.
Equitable Giving Circle. I know I just lovingly say EGC because it's easy peasy, but Equitable Giving Circle, EGC. So tell us about this amazing organization that we started.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, it was right before shutdown happened with the pandemic. We were at Open House on MLK. Cole Reed was like, there's this woman named AJ. Leah, you should meet her. I think you would meld really well. Y'all have to meet each other. So I was at the Black Happy Hour at the co-working space, and we met and we started talking, and then the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
And once the pandemic hit, we were trying to figure out ways of supporting community. Mm-hmm. So as we were sitting in our homes from our computers, the start of EGC literally came from us coming together and saying, how are we going to support community? What does this look like? Mm-hmm. And again, I always appreciate having people in my life that pushes me, because we were just like, we're going to do 30 food boxes. And we're going to feed 30.
It was 50. We started off with
50.
It was 50.
It was 50 food boxes. And we're going to feed 50 families for an X amount of time.
For the summer.
And then AJ was just like, what if we did 100?
No, wait. We dropped that fundraiser. Remember, we dropped the fundraiser.
Well, I think you asked, like, oh, can't we do more? And then in my mind, I was like, the math is not mathing. We do not have enough money to do, like, where are we going to get this money from? And then we dropped the fundraiser.
We raised like $30,000 in a week.
And then AJ was like, okay, what if we did more?
Yeah, this is also why I can't go to Vegas because I'd be like, we run a little bit of money. Let's see what happens.
And I'm standing in the background. No, we should not. Like, what's going on here?
I do not go to Vegas. Last time I went to Vegas, I slept the entire time. I went with a bunch of friends and they were like, she's the most boring Vegas person. But I found the pool relaxing and I was like, that's what I'm here for.
And then we started to feed families and the funding started rolling in. And then, you know, as we were doing this, thinking about distribution, I remember going on Facebook and talking to groups. I'm like, okay, what's the best way of, how do we best get food out to families? Like, what are your thoughts and ideas? And we're coming together doing all this work. And the funding kept on coming in and we were able to add more and more families. And as we were doing this and as we were working together, coming together to get this work done, I was just so grateful because, again, like, I think that, like, I was still in the shock of, like, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. Everything is shut down. You would go outside and there would be no cars on the street. And we're trying to put together a distribution model to feed hundreds of families weekly with fresh fruits and vegetables from local BIPOC farms. And it was something that so many people told us, we can't do. Mm-hmm. This is impossible. What are y'all thinking? You know, like, I guess you can do policy, do it for a little bit, but it's not going to move forward. But we proved everyone wrong. And it was, at the time, Black, Indigenous, Women, and Femme-led organization that came together and was just like, by any means necessary, we were going to make sure people were fed. Because we knew when the economic downturn hit, Black and brown families were the first to feel a big impact of that. And people were going hungry. And again, if my neighbors are not good, I am not good. And I don't think any of us that was in those rooms, that were in those spaces, was okay with the fact that we were seeing it in the community. We were seeing people struggle. We were seeing people ask for help. And we were like in the midst of a global pandemic that no one knew at that time. No one knew. They were just like, good luck, y'all. Hopefully you can find a mask and, you know, stay safe. So it took radical imagination to pull together a program in the crust or in like the midst of a global pandemic that everyone said that would not make it. And as we kept on doing that, as we kept on building this no strings attached giving model, I believe that we birthed and we carried on a legacy of like work of like, I was just like, as like Black mothers, we're going to get the job done. Like, period, point blank. There was nothing that was going to stop us once we were just like, whether we had to drive our own vehicles, whether we had to, again, reaching out for community support and asking for the funds, asking for people to volunteer. It came together so beautifully. And as we shifted from like a crisis response organization to a community cornerstone of support with a variety of, whether it's food support, housing support, wellness support, there's this line of like, how do we then create programming that allows people to exist, Black and brown people to exist and to have the supports that they need, no strings attached, in a way that allows them to feel supported and seen. I think that one thing that really stood out to us as we were building this model was the fact that many of us has experienced food insecurities at one time within our lifetimes. You know, I grew up on Williams Ave when the food bank was on Williams Ave. And I just remember like my mother going to the food bank and being disrespected, like in the food bank, and just having to sit there because you had to wait in line to get your stuff, or having volunteer hours at the food bank because you had to give back. Or just not just being treated or being like, oh, you're taking too many things, or I was just like, you know, so like we did not want to create that vibe. So I think it's just a beautiful full circle that so many amazing women and femmes could come together to create this model and to allow families to do our weekly pantry, which is on Thursday at Alder Commons from 10 to 2, where they can come and they can get this fresh fruits and vegetables and a beautiful vibe that, you know, just is amazing. And that when we deliver our food to our families, people are just like, the fruits and vegetables that they get, it rivals some of our most artisan food, our food vendors that we'll see within the Pacific Northwest. And everyone's just like, ooh, can I buy a box? because I was just like, I mean, like, I would want to buy a box too because it's that fresh and it's within 24 hours that the food's picked and it's on our family's table. Mm-hmm. So having that and building that model has been just amazing, and having so many amazing people to build it with has been, you know, has pushed my limits in ways that I've never thought to be pushed before. But also it has been so invigorating having people say, like, but what if we can do it? Like, yeah. What would this look like if we do succeed? And I do think sometimes, like, when you're trying to reimagine the world around you, you need people. Like, when you get tired of, like, trying to reimagine what can look different, you need somebody to be like, hey, I'm going to share you my radical vision until your radical vision shows back up. But I always appreciate you, AJ, because that's what you gave me. Because I was like, how are we going to do this? Like, in my mind, I was like, how are we going to do this? Yeah. And you shared a radical vision that I was just like, let's figure out how to do this. And then that helped reignite mine, like, during this time.
I so appreciate that. And I know some people, like, credit me with, like, the spark. But the reality is that idea would still be a Google document if, hey, Google, you could sponsor us. holler at me, info@equitablegivingcircle.org. I love an email from you. that's not a bill. I love that you bring up, like, the way this came about, but this idea without this incredible team, right? Mm-hmm. To hear an idea and then to help move it, right? Yeah. Like, it was this idea, like, this big idea that it was like, that's cool. And then there's all of this talent that stepped up across the color line. I want to, like, you know, we are led as a Black and originally Indigenous. And we've had some change over the last three of board members, but, you know, Black women coming together, but we've also had some incredible accomplices, allies who help move the work and who, you know, participate, so it's just an incredible amount of passion and talent that picked up this idea as a team, right? Like, you know, that circle game that kids play with, like, that parachute?
Oh, yeah.
I think of that, right? Where it's like, here was this big idea and not one person could pick this up and move it, but everybody picked up their part and it started to move. It started to have waves.
That's so true.
We got to now do, like, that activity at something. Daivisha's gonna be like, AJ,
like, what,
another I want to have an event sometime where we, like, do a stone soup activity, so maybe we'll also do a parachute thing as we go and grow. And we've been doing this now for 3 years.
Yes, we hit our 3-year mark last March.
Yes, so March was the third year of us getting this rolling, and then June is our makes a third year of consistent ongoing produce delivery. That's just incredible. And we've consistently been delivering to our number of families that we serve consistently has been about 350. Sometimes it's been higher, but that's kind of our base that we've set, and once we're at, right, I think we're like 360 because pantry's been growing, but that's been a steady number, and the goal for us is absolutely to grow because this is scalable.
Yes.
And while we've gotten lots of money when we first started because of, you know, George Floyd's death, unfortunately, happened, and it sparked a lot of, you know, interest and care and response. But we're still fundraising. So if you're hearing this and you feel inclined, holler at becoming a reoccurring donor, holler at making a one-time donation, maybe donate us some property. Hit us up because we're absolutely always fundraising and absolutely would love to chat with you about that. And all dollar amounts matter.
Yeah, that's so true.
So that is a bit of our origin story. and so now what, tell us a little bit about, I mean, I know, but what are we doing? What's going on?
What are we doing? Like I said a little earlier, kind of as we transition from a crisis response organization to a community cornerstone organization, our work is drastically grown and expanded. And I think that as we were building out our no strings attached giving model, we recognized that, you know, it's not just food. So when we're thinking about, like, the different pillars that needs to exist for families to have support, it's food, it's housing, it's wellness activities and events that allows people to grow and heal, like in their places and spaces that they prefer to be in. So as again, we have our amazing CSA program, our flagship program, and in our weekly pantry. So we're feeding, I think at our pantry, like we have like over doubled our number since the beginning of the year. We're consistently now feeding 90 to 95 families. Right now, I can only see that number growing as we enter into the summertime. We now have a housing program that we are in the process of seeking grant dollars to fund. We have some really...
With the housing, though, we have been able to put out a little bit of money.
Yeah. So probably within the last year or so, we were able to put out rent and mortgage support grants to families that we serve. So that was an amazing, amazing venture that we moved through. And we're looking to move forward similar models like that to, again, stabilize families' housing situations, because we know the moment that a family is thrown into housing insecurity, the likelihood it takes, you know, at least close to 5 years for them to work their way out of that cycle as a minimum. After being thrown into that instability, we also know that once that happens, that particularly families of color are more likely to have adverse interactions with police, which DHS, because of poverty. And so we are actively trying to figure out ways of supporting families, you know, in the interim with, again, housing support. But we also have really grand ideas. Can I talk about the grand ideas?
Absolutely. Okay.
We also have really grand ideas about different housing models to actively support families. So the big idea that I am pitching right now is we want to build or purchase a apartment building so that we can house Black single mothers for a minimum of 3 to 4 years rent free. During this time, it will provide them time to take rest, heal, grow, go to school, do the things that they need to do as they're actively working towards building down payment supports for stabilized housing after their time. So we hope that after the 3 to 4 year time period and access of state level IDA programs, also additional down payment supports and closing cost supports, that they will be really competitive in the Portland housing market so they can purchase their own home, their own condo, their own townhome, so that they we can, again, reinvest generational wealth within the Black community and allow these families to enter into this housing market that has been a cutthroat world. Anyone that's been trying to buy a house in the Portland metro area understands. And so that they can, again, start building generational wealth for their families. So that's our real big idea. And I do think it's a scalable model because we have to ask ourselves, you can't save your way out of poverty.
No.
Even if you're if you live in the Portland metro area and you're making even close to $80,000 a year, which most people are not. The medium income is like maybe $50,000 a year if you, you know, if you were able to survive the pandemic and you maintain a particular job. So it's not about like how do we then help stabilize families in this cohort model that will increase the number of Black home ownership within our state. And also create a scalable model that we could not only see within our state, but across the nation. And that's what, you know, I'm really excited about, creating those innovative models that will ultimately set the standard of how we would like to see families supported.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this programming. And I'm very excited, you know, to continue to show folks that, like, as we're imagining different things, we can try things out. Because I'd say both within our food program, because we were met with so many like, oh, that doesn't make sense. You can't do that. That's not a thing. That won't be successful. I think there's even some with that around housing. But it's like, hey, y'all, we keep doing the same things and not getting new results. Perhaps we need to start doing some new things. Maybe some of the things are working. Maybe we need to tweak it. And that's really the crux of this. And also all of our work is trying to address some of the root causes. You know, like people don't realize within food support, the one, like, what's so great about our home delivery is it takes away that step of having to get to the place, schlep the food across town if you don't have a car. Maybe, you know, I remember one time having to go to a food pantry and, like, I was having an injury and it was just, like, the most ridiculous thing, right? Getting there with my hobbled situation and what, you know, so the home delivery kind of takes over, takes out some of that, those barriers, and the consistency makes a difference for people to be able to plan appropriately. And same with the housing, like, this is addressing, you know, root issues and helping people get, you know, get over the hump, get over the hurdle. Cause our community, the Black community, is honestly loudly at a 400 year deficit, right? Like, we're behind. And a lot, there's people that definitely this doesn't apply to, and that's wonderful. But as a collective, we are not getting to compete in the same ways because we're having to deal with, you know, generations of oppression. So I love that we are loudly trying to address root issues. And also this work is an invitation to let's try things differently.
Yeah.
I don't want to leave out our community wellness. And we just had this really beautiful, our annual Mother's Day celebration this weekend. And can you tell me a little bit, not me, just me, I know, but can you tell us all a little bit about our community wellness work?
Yeah, Devesha Gordon is our community wellness director. And
she's wonderful.
She's amazing. So creative. So, like, I just love working with her. And if I have some, if I need someone to ask me questions, I mean, she would be the one that would ask, because she will hit you with some good ones.
She's so thoughtful in everything that she does.
She is. She is. She always just makes me, like, pause. It's like, okay.
And thoughtful in ways that I didn't, sometimes didn't even think of. Like, I'll use this beautiful example. I had gotten some really hard news not too long ago, and the whole team, shout out to this beautiful, wonderful team, had a little care package for me, and it was brought over to me. And I know this is a Devesha touch, and I'm just, it's so lovely. She picked out these different herbs that can be used for tea and wrote, like, what the herb is and what it is. Like, this supports your nervous system. This will support, you know, this helps if you're feeling a little sad. Like, it's, you know, like, so she, and I know she wrote it because it's her beautiful, she has really beautiful penmanship.
It was her.
Yeah. And her kid is going to have the most beautiful penmanship because it's 6 years old, almost seven. They also have really, really strong, beautiful handwriting. And it was just, you know, like, she is that person that, like, pauses and is, you know, is very deliberate. And it's just, it's so beautiful to witness and to be, you know, in community with her and to build with her. And I just shout out to all of her thoughtfulness.
Yeah. So yearly we have these amazing events and care packages that goes out to community members. So the recent, the most recent event was our Mother's Day event that happened last weekend, which was a, you know,
it was a mom's, a celebration for Black mothers.
Yeah.
Celebration. It was beautiful.
Beautiful. And, like, these events are, you know, we have healers, we have massage therapists, I believe there was sound bowls, there's gift items, there's flowers, and it's just a space to be and exist.
This
with
one,
no care, like, no care and cares in the world.
It gets super relaxing. This one was one of the things that she did at this one that was really cool. We had fresh flowers, which we always do, and, you know, house plants. And then there was also, like, vegetable starts and some little vegetable garden-y thingies or, I don't grow vegetable plants, just house plants. But she also wanted to have dried flowers. And then we also had some beautiful paper flowers by Kelly Liu. You know Kelly.
Yeah.
And
Kelly gets your taxes done, right?
Right. Shout out to Kelly. She's amazing. She's really good, and she explains everything. I don't think she's taking clients, but get on her list. But it was, I loved it. She said, Devesha said, you know, I really want to make sure that everybody can leave with flowers, and not everybody can do, you know, if you have allergies, there's somebody I take flowers to regularly, and I know certain flowers never to bring because they bother. I know what they like, and I know what agitates their allergies. So Divesian said, I want to make sure that everybody can leave here. So we had the dried flowers and then the paper flowers. And so now there's options for everybody. And I loved that intentionality mm-hmm. and that inclusion. Like, she's so inclusive with that, like, in ways that I think the rest of us will just gloss over. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like,
oh, I would have never thought about that.
Yeah, I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that we had been excluding people based off of allergies. And look how organically you have found this solution. Mm-hmm. And I loved being able to build with her because she invites us to slow down sometimes.
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, we have annual, our Earth Day event, our Mother's Day mm-hmm. event. We have our holiday extravaganza, which we will soon be starting to plan for. And our Books and Brew event we do last year. So again, it's just creating community spaces mm-hmm. for healing. And I do believe that's a component of wellness that we don't always think about mm-hmm. When you're in the grind, when you're in the hustle, when you're constantly fighting systems of oppression, when you're constantly being in some aspects, not supported in the places that you are in, having culturally specific spaces to just exist in, even for a few hours, can be the things that get you over that hump. Mm-hmm. And I truly appreciate having intentional, thought out events like that mm-hmm. for our families and for the larger Portland Metro community.
Yep. And I think so, just so people know too, within our community wellness work, now we have some game nights this year. Mm-hmm. We're working on some workshops. I'm doing two workshops this year. One, it's an art grief workshop. Mm-hmm. I'm working with Soul Restoration on it. And then I'm doing one that's about fundraising, which is needed for community healing and wellness. So holler at me if you want to attend that.
And shout out for Black Family Game Night. So all those who came to the last Black Family Game Night, it was amazing. We had such a great time. Jeopardy was on point. We're having another one coming up pretty soon. So please keep your eye out on that. And it's just, it was an amazing amount of fun to be in community and just laughing and joking and doing all the things. So,
So all of that. And then we also do care packages that Lillian had mentioned. I got to help with our last batch of care packages. And it seems like such a big project, and mm-hmm. it is. But it also just goes by, and it's really fun. And it's really exciting to see how people react and their response to the care packages. And the care packages are self-care items, fun, yummy snacks, coffee, tea, all that kind of stuff. And given to the families we serve, we have lists of elders and some other, organizers and stuff that we support, and we've done where people can nominate folks in the past. And what's so special about those care packages is the individual who gets them, there's all kinds of yummy, fun, exciting things for them. And then the things that they don't, that's not really, they're like, meh, they get to then share that with their mm-hmm. loved ones. And something that I know that a lot of people don't realize how important that is, that the gift of sharing and being able to share is something that if you are experiencing financial hardship, you might not be able to do that in the same kind mm-hmm. of way. There's a story of this woman who had went on some mission trip, and she had told an elder, oh, you don't need those baby clothes or whatever. And the elder was really offended. And some other organizer had intervened, was like, hey, that's the reason why you don't do that, and why that elder does want that is she wants to bring that to, a new baby that's in her life. And in the story, it was a neighbor that she's basically grandma mm-hmm. to. So she wanted to be able to give that baby a new gift. And so mm-hmm. the woman who had tried to stop it at first, had that lesson of sharing mm-hmm. in our community looks different. And we talk about this as a team, we don't worry about in those care packages of things going to waste.
Yeah.
Because we know that the folks that we're sharing with, they are going to be excited to share as well. Mm-hmm. There's a box that's delivered in Northeast Portland to an elder. And this one box, because she's on the corner, there's two blocks, on one side of her house and the other side. I was over there one day, and she had gotten her box the day before. And then she was different neighbor. She had sectioned it out. And I was what's happening with this? And she was well, it's not too much for me, but we walked down and delivered it to a neighbor, and somebody mm-hmm. else had walked, came by to pick up, I don't know, whatever it was corn or something, because she didn't, she's like, I don't like that. But it was so cute that she shared it with, like, the whole block is supported with that one box.
Yeah, and you think one thing that we always bring up, we always talk about, you would think that those with the least, like, you know, to give would give less, but they are the ones in our society that gives the most mm-hmm. and gives more of, like, what do they have available, and sometimes things that they may not per se. Well, like, hey, if once she, they give this away, they won't have access to that. They won't be yeah. able to utilize those things, but they're helping a neighbor. So I always like the, like, as we're talking about, like, this concept of giving, and too, I challenge people to, like, start digging deep, because I know, like, I'm one of the lessons of giving that, like, I remember when my dad passed away, when the kids, like, they had, like, this poster board, because he was working at Franklin High School at the time, and people were, like, taping dollars on, like, this big sheet of paper. And I was like, what, like, what's going on? Like, what's going on with the dollar? And he was just like, well, there was one day I didn't have lunch, and Mr. Green, like, you know, Mr. Green came up and he was like, this is the only dollar I got. Like, go on, take this dollar and go get something. And I was just like, people who don't, I'm like, my dad had 10 kids. He was doing the most. Like, we probably fleeced his dollars before he got out the door. And, like, he was giving his last out of his pocket mm-hmm. to make sure that a kid that, like, he in the school that he worked at had something. And those kids remembered that and, like, was taping dollars on, like, this, like, a goodbye Mr. Green poster. So I always challenge and ask people to think, like, how are you challenging yourself to give? Because I see so many individuals in our community gifting in such beautiful, creative ways that could be dollars, could not be dollars, mm-hmm. but they are sharing in creative ways in which some of us may not even imagine that we should mm-hmm. be sharing it.
Yeah. Well, and sharing looks like so many things. I mean, it's definitely, please share your time and your dollars, and that's important. Mm-hmm. And also, yeah, engage with the other ways that you can share, like, whether it's, you know, passing on clothes,
yeah.
like, you know, or, like, especially with kids. I think I'm out of that phase now with mine. But I remember, you know, making, like, I remember sorting and making sure, like, the stuff that was nice, that, you know, is still mm-hmm. in good condition. I had, you know, kind of a rough and tumble boy when he still can be that way. he'll probably be like, Mom. But I remember, like, passing that stuff on, mm-hmm. and that makes a difference. It could be sharing a meal, you know. I like to share books, you know. One of my best friends, she shares music mm-hmm. regularly. She, I mean, honestly, I listen to everything that she, it's just, I love you. my music is better because of you. So there's a lot of different ways to share. And I think a lot mm-hmm. of people forget about that. And, you know, once you start engaging with it, yes, there's the easy things and you should do those. Mm-hmm. And then it's also getting into it. The things that are a little more creative or a little more complicated or, mm-hmm. but sharing looks like a lot of stuff. Like
yeah.
on my way here, I was chit-chatting with, I stopped and got coffee and had a lovely conversation. It's called Never Coffee. So if you need a cheerful a bunch, pop in there. And we just shared a nice conversation and they asked what I was about to do. And it was just really lovely. And like, as I left, I said, gosh, thank you for sharing this moment with me. And both the people that were behind the counter, like, they smiled. And I was just like, and for those lovely smiles. Like, it was just yeah. this nice moment. And, you know, that, even sharing that, like, that definitely, not that my day was going bad or anything, but it was a really a bright spot. And it yeah. sort of, it was like, oh, and I'll carry that the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to just jump into this next question.
Okay.
What's something folks don't know about EGC?
Ooh. Dang, AJ.
Coming in hot.
Oh, that's really hard because I feel like everything we do is, like, really, like,
just out there.
Just
yeah.
out there. I think sometimes people think that EGC is way bigger than it actually is. Like, mm. I mean, like, we're tiny but mighty. Like, we have five full-time employees that are actively working to move this ship.
We got Deanna, who's a contractor
yeah, we
that
have
we're
Deanna.
Trying to bring on full-time. So, hey, funders, we need some money.
Hey. But yeah, so I was just like, we're tiny but mighty, but I think it also shows how it shows our intentionality about like how we move, like what we put our energy and focus in to help serve families within our community and do it with love and care. And I always think that's like one of the big things. Like, I hope that everything that we do out there does not feel transactional. It's done from a very intentional space. And I do think that I think people will be not surprised, but like the sheer amount of time that we take and we reflect on, like, after we have event, what worked, what didn't work, what do we need to shift? When do we need to start to make the event better? I do think like those are like just core conversations that I think that sometimes you don't always get or that may be glossed over. And I think that's like, we don't work well if we're not having those intentional types of conversations and like thinking about how we're going to make shifts and changes for the community that we serve.
I have one that kind of adding on that we are really committed to pivoting. If things aren't working, or, you know, we're like, okay, how can we do this differently? And then we're constantly asking those questions and that we're really agile in that way. I like to attribute that to that we're millennials. Shout out to millennials. Anyone who has negative things about millennials, we are out here doing the work. We are a very millennial team, and we get to witness other millennials doing cool stuff. So if any of you have thoughts about millennials not living up to our potential, we are out here living up to our potential and then some.
Yeah, I do think that being able to pivot, and again, like, When we talk about pivoting, it's like within our bodies of work, really being able to meet communities where they're at and meet community needs. And like, I do think we humble ourselves where we're like, hey, we thought this would be the best way to deliver these services, but actually it's not. And our community is telling us loud and clear, we would like to see something different. So then being able to pivot and being okay with that shifts away from, like, I do think sometimes you sit and you're just like, with the best thoughts in our minds, we came up with this solution and then we want to put this solution out there. But once we receive the feedback, you know, like, hey, actually this ain't what you thought it was going to be.
Lunch and Learns is a good example of pivoting. It's programming that we had, and it was like, it's in some ways it's like easy, right? So we've been doing these Lunch and Learns for, this is kind of has been under community wellness, is this opportunity for monthly for folks to gather and have conversations. We would have like a presentation, and it'd be this, you know, educational opportunity to talk about our work, what we're doing, how this relates in community. And the first, I'd say 18 months that we were doing them, they were really robust. And then as the world started opening back up, it just kind of dwindled, and like,
people want to see each other in person.
and our team was just like, we were over it, right? Like, we were doing it, but like, we were all over it. And it was kind of like, well, let's examine that. Let's ask questions about that. And so that's actually how we evolved into now we're doing this podcast. But it also had some of our other programming. We had a virtual happy hour, which did make sense during the height of the pandemic as this opportunity for people to gather. And that's actually now going to be migrating into our Giving Circle meetup, because we are a Giving Circle and we've got 613 reoccurring monthly donors trying to grow that. So sign up at $40, $20, $100 a month and be part of that, this magic with us. And you can do that on our website, www.equitablegivingcircle.org. Again, equitablegivingcircle.org. But like, us being intentional about this programming of like, oh, we can shift it. It's even Plant Jam, right? So that's another part of community wellness where we, when we first were doing it, like, we were tabling at a bunch of different stuff. And now we pass out plants both at pantry, when we do have community events, wellness, but we're not schlepping stuff in the same capacity. And it's just, it's like, what makes sense for us as a team? What makes sense for to keep this work relevant and growing? And there's probably other examples, but I love that. All right. Definitely, we are a small but mighty team, and we have opportunities to volunteer. So if you're listening and you want to be activated, holler at that website again, equitablegivingcircle.org. Go to the volunteer page and sign up. And if you want to sign up as a volunteer, you fill out a little application. Then once you've done that, you can come to the once a month volunteer orientation, and it's really great. We talk about how we operate, what we're doing, what we got mm-hmm. going on, how and where to plug in. And then from there, you'll get your sign up sheet. It's really easy and you can sign up, and their shift's literally probably out into infinity.
Yeah.
So, and you know, then that's that. And then you show up, and highly recommend just having, you know, once a month, once a week, whatever makes mm-hmm. sense for you, but just be regular and consistent, because we actually really like to get to know our volunteers.
Yeah.
Shout out to one of our volunteers, John.
Hey, John. Hey. We love you.
We do. He is one of our most consistent volunteers. Coming up on his two, it's been over 2 years, but
it has to be over 2 years.
It has to be over 2 years. But he's just a very consistent, caring, loving volunteer. I'm down to help. And we love that we've gotten to get to know this mm-hmm. individual over time. He's so sweet. He's a former educator. And he's really committed. The news was at Pantry last week, and he did the little interview, and they didn't actually put it in the thing. But I took a picture, and what was the cutest thing ever was Sean was, like, packing strawberries, and he was like, the interview person was trying to get him to stop, and John was like, you go have to hold the thing because I'm not stopping my work. I was like, shout out to John, who's like, by any means necessary,
by any means necessary,
we're getting y'all fed. So I'm gonna ask you what is the question for me.
I mean, EGC has, you know, has evolved in ways in which I don't know if we all even, I know I didn't really imagine it. You may have, but where do you see us going in the future?
Well, I'd say I didn't imagine us to be here, but I always imagine us just being consistent and being a different than what is available.
Mm-hmm.
For the future, I want us to grow. I want us to really show Portland, serve more people. So, like, the goal is to get our food program up to serving, you know, like 1,000 people a week. Goal with the housing is really to get that moving, both with the mm-hmm. reoccurring, you know, being able to do three month rent and mortgage relief grants, mm-hmm. as well as fully realizing this housing program to house yep. Black mothers, single mothers, you know, for a good chunk of time for free. I want us to continue to build out, like, these are the ways that we can be doing this work different.
Mm-hmm.
Portland is a place, and I don't know if everybody knows this, and depending on, you know, what sector of work that you're in, you might not know this, is a place that is teaching sustainability and urban development globally.
Yeah.
You know, we, through our colleges, there's a lot of different interesting programs and projects that are here. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people that are educating around, you know, sustainability, not just around, like, buildings and transportation, but even around, like, recycling and mm-hmm. different ways that we can have sustainable programming within our city. It's also a place where urban development has been studied, perfected. This is a place where, you know, gentrification has, you know, depending on what historian you're speaking to, it's waves. We're like, I don't mm-hmm. remember, like, wave 18 or something.
Yeah.
It's a lot. So I really want us as a team and as an organization to continue to show this work can be done in different ways that addresses the root problem, mm-hmm. And being a solution to a place that, you know, is teaching things. And honestly, Portland is teaching these things, but it doesn't always feel good or positive, because when you think about the legacy of Oregon, this was an exclusionary state, meaning Black people were not allowed to live here. It was against the law. Thinking about the way white supremacy really has a chokehold in the Pacific Northwest, and, you know, people are in denial about it. And I could get in the weeds of that. So if you want to, holler at my email, because I will talk your ear off and you'll be like, never again. But I want people to, in this place where these things are being taught. I once was talking to somebody that works in the city in the Bureau of Sustainability, and she said, this was Michelle DePass. She said, when I think about Portland, she doesn't work in that department anymore, but when she said that Portland is teaching white, you know, is teaching these things, and this is, it's teaching this whiteness, it's teaching sustainability, but it's void of Black people. And it, like, that hit me and has sat with me for a very long time. And so I want us here to be able to use this work as an example of we can have holistic solutions. We can have solutions that have dual impact and show that, right? With our food programming, we are supporting literally 350 plus families a week with food access through these two programs. But the dollars we're spending is staying in the community because we work with Black and Brown farmers. We're mm-hmm. making sure that when we're buying large amounts of food, we're working with Black and Brown vendors or food mm-hmm. purveyors. And I think that, like, that's my goal, is to continue to lean into yeah. that and to be, you know, an example. And something that people don't realize too around this kind of work, legacy work, around Black liberation work, around food access work, or just in general solutions, there's not a lot of data, right? Like, because a lot of the way the government and foundations fund is an invitation to do differently. This is not coming from no one's throat. I know, like, y'all like to position me as that person. But there's an opportunity to fund things differently and to do things differently where we can show, right? Like, EGC is never, we're not chasing dollars, and we're going after dollars, but mm-hmm. we're not changing our program to fit dollars. Yeah. And so wanting to use this work as that example, and an invitation, like, we can collectively work together to do things differently. And as a place that's teaching, you know, sustainability void of Black people to the world, I want us to be part of the solution of ways to be inclusive and to be sustainable, and that this work can look different. Because I think yes. that because of the way so many really amazing programs get messed over due to funding, I want to be a part of that. Like, but here's data of what it looks like for a long time. One of my mm-hmm. favorite, you know, things when we hear get feedback from people is, after so long in this program, we started seeing that after about 13 months, right? That, mm-hmm. oh, after 13 months of this consistent food support, our family was able to save dollars and invest differently and make changes. And now mm-hmm. our family's financials, our family situation looks differently. And the thing about Black and Brown people is they're not just hanging out on the program just because. We've seen people that they're like, our situation is improved. We want somebody else to be able to use yeah. this service. So, I just want us to continue to grow. I like that we are, you know, moved from this crisis response to being a consistent community cornerstone and wanting to grow that. We are actively trying to get into a building mm-hmm. And just building out, because this is needed. Food access and consistency is needed. And this work intersects, you know, not just with food, housing, and community wellness, but these things. Having access to programming like this, food, and these kinds of support, no strings attached, interrupts domestic violence, which is another issue I'm really passionate about, not creating it, but solving it, supporting people. You know, child education, mm-hmm. if kids are fed, they are going to do mm-hmm. better in school. Their focus is better. If mom and dad, grandma are fed, they are calmer people. They're able to focus and do the things. And we can go on and on with all the places that this work intersects. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to keep us going and growing and, you know, being able to collect this data and share that this is why and how we can do mm-hmm. different. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
That's yeah. So we've got two more things before we wrap up. A book recommendation for today is this book called Ritual by Maladoma Patrice Somay. I gave this book out for Black History Month, I want to say in 2021, was maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
Something like that. And so that's like a project that I've been doing where, like, Black History Month, I've just like pass out a book. And this book is really beautiful. Did you read this?
Yeah.
Thanks. So, and I'm always like, did you read it to everybody? I love this book. So this book is about rituals and about community and grounding. And it really compares the difference between the author's home in Africa and here, how we are in community in America, in the West, really. And so it really talks about the difference of ritual, not just in, like, you know, rituals like church or a graduation, mm-hmm. but the rituals of being able to be in community and conversation, and how it's so differently if there's a conflict. If I'm in community with somebody, that it's easier to say, hey, this is a little off or weird, or like the kind of the way that aunties and uncles can corral somebody because they're in community. Yeah. And so it really just talks about the different ways, like the foundation that we are situated in our community, and also the way that we're celebrating. And something that like I've been really reflecting the last couple of years, and I think partly COVID really disrupted that, because it's just weird to celebrate. It was so weird, right? I remember like right when COVID hit was my dad, it's one of his birthdays, one of his like 60th birthday. And we had I threw him this virtual / drive-by party. That sounds really weird. But we had people like, I had my parents out on their little front deck area and waving. And we had like 30 people drove by honking. Aww. And we had put like juice boxes out so that people could like, get them. And my dad has this really beautiful garden, and that's like his, what he shares with the community. And so people, our neighbors intentionally also walked by and waved. So it was this whole evening. And that was one of those things that and this book that really started to get me even engaging differently. It was like, what are we celebrating? How are we celebrating it? And even celebration is something that has been disrupted and lost within our larger community due to chattel slavery, due to colonization, you know, due to capitalism even. And, you know, so this book kind of touches on all those things. It sounds way, I'm like making it sound like really complicated, but it's a really fast read. It's like 100 pages and it's a delightful read. I tell everybody to read it because it's just a really lovely invitation to just engage and think differently of what we're doing and how we're centering things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is our book recommendation of the day of this episode. So please read it. Send us an email or a DM. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And as always, you know, EGC, Equitable Giving Circle, we're trying to grow our work, our giving circle. So just tap in. Please sign up as a reoccurring donor. Come be a volunteer. Mm-hmm. If you've got, you know, something that you can share with our community wellness program or a property, that help us realize our work even faster, get a hold of us via the website, email, DMs, not on Facebook, but Instagram DMs. That's where we be at. 'Cause we're millennials. So that's the social media you can find us on.
Yes. Working on that TikTok.
We really are. And if you're a Gen Z and you want to come volunteer and help us with that, holler at us. We would love to talk to you. And our very last thing is we have a homework assignment or an action item, action task, however you like to say it. And I say that those different ways because I got a teenager who's always like, I don't know about the way you say that, Mom. So he would absolutely be annoyed if I told him I was giving him homework. Teens. So today I'll let Lillian tell y'all what our action homework is.
Well, our action homework is, I think it's simple but yet so impactful. We're gonna ask you to call somebody. I want you to think about somebody. This person's probably been running across your mind. You've been thinking about them, they've been sitting on your heart for some reason. I want you to give them a call and check in. If that morphs into coffee, morphs into a dinner, even better. But call, have an intentional conversation. Let them know that you're thinking about them and like kind of what you've been thinking about them about. And yeah. I this recently happened to me. One of my friends, Kiyoshi, called me out of the blue one morning, like after I dropped off the kiddos to school. And it was just a beautiful moment. Like, you were thinking about me? And it was like, made me tear up. And there's so much there, but it was such an impactful moment just to have that call. That I invite you to do the same thing. And as we were talking about sharing, sometimes can look in a variety of ways. So share your thoughts with this individual that's probably been running across your mind for a while.
Yeah. And in that, like slowing down and taking time and sharing, like as you're having the conversation, share some good things, you know, share why or what brought them to mind. And yeah. Have a good chat. Sharing moments in community is a really simple way that we can share, but a really beautiful and, as Lillian just said, a very impactful and the more that we engage with sharing, the more mm-hmm. that we realize this is part of our biology. This is something that's really natural. And it makes us all feel better and it makes the world better.
So true.
Go out there and share.
Share it.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.